Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics Podcast. Australia is part of this week's big Western diplomatic push against Russia in the wake of the nerve agent poisoning of former Russian double agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter in Britain. Two members of the Russian embassy in Canberra, identified by Australian intelligence authorities as spies, are being expelled. The Russian ambassador in Canberra, in a long and extraordinary news conference on Wednesday, denied the pair were spies, as well as repeating Russia's rejection of having any part in the poisoning.
Even if they were intelligence officers, I would never tell it, but my embassy consists only of professional diplomats.
Today we're joined by Professor John Blaxland, the head of the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the Australian National University, to discuss the latest developments in the Skripal affair. John Blaxland, more than 20 countries are expelling more than 100 Russian diplomats. But will this have any effect on Russia, which in turn is likely to undertake some expulsions of its own? Will the Russians just shrug the whole thing off?
I think we can be confident to expect Vladimir Putin to try and shrug it off and for Russian media to not give it that much attention. But I think it's pretty clear that this will have a significant effect on Russia, particularly on Russia's ability to conduct influence operations and more offensive operations like the targeted assassination attempt in Britain recently. So we are seeing the Russians basically being put on the back foot.
So you think they'll cut down on these efforts?
The people who are being targeted for expulsion, my understanding is that they are overwhelmingly people who are identified as lead protagonists in this space. So the lead players identified by organisations like ASIO and their counterparts abroad as being the most likely and the most probable participants in activities that would be associated with that kind of action.
So they're not just spies, but they're also people who track down dissidents or others that the Russians want to target.
Well, that's right. And they may do that not directly, or they might do it indirectly through third-hand agents working on behalf of the Russian government. But the convenient thing about an undeclared officer is that they have the cover of diplomatic privilege that enables them to move freely, undertake activities that would enable them to avoid the level of scrutiny and interference from public authorities, local authorities, that's considered to be a considerable asset for chasing down targets potentially to be killed, or targets who are just want to hassle or monitor and intimidate.
Now, the Russians have denied involvement in the poisoning. Mm. Could you run us through the evidence that, in fact, the Russian state was behind this?
Look, of course, the Russians are denying that they were behind it. I'd be shocked if they didn't. But what is clear is that there is a strong disinformation campaign, what the Russians call Maskirovka, that is at work to basically muddy the waters. And one of the things that happens in this business, particularly behind closed doors, the Brits won't be wanting to put on the public record exactly what evidence they have, because they don't want to show their hand to the Russians. But they will, in private, be showing their counterparts in North America, across Europe and in Australia, why they believe the evidence is so compelling. Now, that has convinced all of the wavering Europeans and even the Canadians, along with the United States, to take firm, unprecedented action. So we're talking about evidence that is essentially pretty darned compelling about Russian malfeasance.
Now, you've spoken about agents tracking down people that the Russian state wants to act against, but how extensive are these Russian efforts, and what has caused Britain to draw a line at this point when we have seen attacks beforehand?
Well, we know that the Russians have been ramping up in recent years. This is featured in ASIO reports. Director General of ASIO, Duncan Lewis, has been at pains to make this point in recent years. His growing concern at the activities of countries like Russia in renewing essentially the, the tactics and techniques of the Cold War that are about espionage, about disruption, about intellectual property theft, about intimidation, and about pursuing Russia's national interests as they are perceived by Vladimir Putin. So that's now what's considered part of the game. Now, there's a question there about whether or not we are seeing a renewed Cold War. Lawrence Friedman's written about what he called Cold War 2.0. Essentially, you know, ideologically, we're not seeing that. Russia is not the Soviet Union. It doesn't have an ideological axe to grind against the West. And its circumstances are quite different. It doesn't have the demographics, it doesn't have the economic base of the old Soviet Union. It is a shadow of that former self. And what it does do have, is a profound nuclear weapons capability, a sophisticated cyber attack capability, and a highly developed and as we can see, honed and maintained espionage and sabotage and assassination capability. And the combination of those things means that we are really in a set of circumstances that has generated the will across the West, if you like, broadly defined, to resist. And I think this has caught Vladimir Putin by surprise. You know, here we had Russia looking at Britain, thinking, look, Britain's cut back its defence expenditure. It can't really patrol the gap between Greenland and the UK the way it used to be able to in the Cold War. It's kind of dropped the ball on military and security capabilities. And by the way, it's on the nose in Europe, having initiated Brexit. So let's pick off the Brits. Let's slap them around a bit. And at the same time, intimidate any of those oligarchs who might be thinking about doing something untoward towards Putin, and sending a message domestically about how strong I am, Vladimir. And the combination of factors means that we now have this extraordinary set of circumstances where Europe has united with Britain to reject this and to stand against it and to push back to Russia. Now, we already know there's been sanctions imposed over the downing of the Malaysian Airlines aircraft, the Ukraine crisis, the Crimea, etc. This is a ratcheting up. This has got to be felt by Russia more broadly.
It's as though in the Cold War days, Russia presented a macro threat to the world, and now it's presenting a series of what we might call micro threats. Is that a fair characterization? Very serious threats, but of a different order from the old threat.
Yes, they are, in a sense, micro threats on one level. But the problem is that we now live in a very much an interconnected world, where the vulnerabilities of the Cold War are quite different to the vulnerabilities of the present era. The bottom line is that with a virus, you know, hypothetically, if not in practice, very, very soon, you could open the sluice gates of a dam. You could turn off a power station. You can disrupt computer network systems. You can, you know, more physically, you can cut underwater cables. The Russians are known to have explored exactly where they are and how to do that, and have the technology to physically disrupt those kind of major arterial IT networks on which we have all come to depend. So while on one level it's micro, it is arguably, in terms of consequences, as great, if not greater, than the threat of nuclear weapons, because they are much more accessible. There's a much greater ease and a degree of plausible deniability with which Russia could act. That's not the case with nuclear weapons. And so that does mean that we are facing a pretty grave danger.
Now, during the Cold War, we had a broadly bipolar world with two great powers, the United States and the Soviet Union, facing off but restrained by mutual deterrence. Mm. With the rise of China and the breakup of the Soviet Union, the picture's obviously changed. How do you see Russia's position internationally in this new power balance?
Well, it's a very interesting question, because it would appear that Donald Trump has been, you know, in reaching out to Vladimir Putin, has been seeking to maybe woo him away from China's embrace. My sense is that this sanction, this expulsion of so-called diplomats, spies effectively, from around the Western world, will probably drive Putin further into the arms of President Xi Jinping, who we don't hear nothing about in terms of joining the protest movement, if you like, internationally in reacting to Russia's actions. And that does speak to a world order that is becoming more polarized than it has been since the days of the Cold War. So I think Lawrence Friedman's parallel there of Cold War 2.0, while there isn't the same ideological dimension to it, in terms of the great power balancing act of the Eurasian landmass and the balance of power with Russia and China's alignment and their increasingly assertive, if not revanchist, foreign policy and actions, means that the actions that we've seen diplomatically across Europe and North America and with Australia joining in the last couple of days may well be something we need to get used to as being more the norm than we've seen in a generation.
Do you think Russia has any cause to feel under siege in the contemporary world other than the reactions it invites by its own behaviour?
Look, yes, on one level, that's totally right, Michelle. There is a view out there that, and it's understandable, and it's one that Vladimir Putin has been pushing, that Russia was cheated at the end of the Cold War, that the West pushed into its territory despite apparent assurances that they wouldn't, that NATO took over what was then the Warsaw Pact countries, that Russia was stripped of its power, and it feels very, very much cheated. And so from that point of view, it is understandable that the Russians should kind of rally around a nationalist strongman figure who is seen as having brought some glory back to Mother Russia, and in a way akin to what Xi Jinping is seeing as being his legacy as well. And that means that we've got few good options at the moment. There's some debate at the moment about whether or not we should have pushed the West, Australia included, should have pushed so hard against Russia. But, you know, we face in Vladimir Putin somebody who has resisted overtures for engagement, for constructive rapprochement with the West for some years now. And that, I think, feeds into there's an internal logic to Putin's resistance to that. It doesn't work for him to reduce the prospect of the bogeyman of the West being a convenient foil for his actions internally and his repression politically, domestically.
Now, we're seeing the role of Russia in the American presidential elections being investigated. How extensive do you think Russian interference is in the politics of other countries, as opposed to what you've been talking about, this just causing trouble role? Do you think that Russia is increasingly wanting to influence the direction of politics in other countries?
I think the evidence is mounting and becoming quite compelling that that is the case.
It wants to try and get certain outcomes, not just cause trouble.
Correct. It is trying to, I think there is a debatable position and a defendable position that Russia's interference in the United States elections matched that in other places in Europe, speaks to an attempt by Putin to persuade elements of those countries more favourably disposed to Russia to take office and to come to a deal that would see Russia better placed. And now that's a debatable case. You know, lots of people would argue the toss either way. I think the argument, the evidence is definitely mounting that is what Putin has tried, and it appears that his cavalier approach to the interests of those countries is now coming back to haunt him. The question is now whether, in light of the revelations of interference in the media with Cambridge Analytica and other things like that, that we will muster in countries like Australia and in Europe and North America a resolve to ensure that we have the capabilities in place to block that kind of influence into the future. Now, that becomes increasingly difficult in an interconnected world in which monopoly of informational power is now very much diffused, on one level diffused and on another level concentrated. Concentrated in terms of platforms like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and the like. So it's really hard, Michelle, to look into the future and see clearly how things are going to unfold. There are a couple of potential forks that we could go down. But my sense is that we are looking at a Russia that is more likely to be increasingly sympathetic to China, for, at least for the short term, because of its congruence of interests and desire to push back and hurt the West somehow for the indignity that is now being imposed upon them.
The federal parliament is, of course, looking at legislation to combat foreign interference, and that debate has all been about China, China's attempted role to have an influence here. Mm. We don't hear about Russia. Has Russia not reached Australia yet in this regard?
The way Russia and China operate is very, very different. I touched on this in the third volume of the ASIO history in the early days, in the late Cold War years, but it's effectively gone from there to the present mode on a not quite a straight linear path, but there's a strong correlation you can see. You can see the trajectory. China's approach is very different to Russia's. China is much more powerful in a sense in terms of its options. It's got many more options for influence in Australia than Russia does. Russia's direct influence on the Australian population, you know, it's relatively marginal. There's an emigre community that some of whom feel an affinity for what's happening in Russia, a lot of whom feel a strong disapproval of. So Russia's options for influence in places like Australia isn't quite the same as China. China, of course, has economic leverage. It has money, buys a lot of favours and influence. A number of people wrote a letter in response to Clive Hamilton's book and the insinuations associated with that. And so what this points to, what I'm getting at, is that there is a live debate in Australia about what should be done, how we respond to pressure from China, and how much we should try and keep this as not being about race, but about political influence, and recognise that there are genuine patriots. The overwhelming majority of Chinese Australians are patriots of Australia who are not under China's sway in an adversarial way. And even those, many of those Australians involved in deals with China are operating in an adversarial way, but are seeking to pursue Australia's interests in a way that may not be quite what people in the national security community see as all that appropriate.
But when it comes to Russia, it's small beer compared to all that.
Yes, because China's influence is, you know, I wrote about this in the book, the ASIO book, about the thousand grains of sand approach. You don't need to operate with a level of clandestinity that the Russians have tended to operate with to get the same effect. But if you've got so many agents of influence, so many people making small-scale contributions that aren't necessarily crossing a legal threshold in terms of illegality, that may be quite legitimate, but when aggregated, give China enormous influence. And that's, I think, what's generating so much angst that's getting the blowback in the national security space.
Now, just before we finish, the Russian ambassador is predictably denying that the two people being expelled from Canberra are spies.
Of course.
How are spies identified? You mentioned your role as the as one of the ASIO historians. Obviously, you've seen a lot of detail about this, but how do the intelligence organisations go about identifying the Russian spies, and why do they leave them here if they're undeclared?
Well, look, it's a very good question, Michelle. When somebody is nominated to be a diplomat to a country, be it Australia or anywhere else, they'll present their credentials, and their credentials will probably indirectly provide a pointer to their pedigree. And whether or not they have got an intelligence background will, you know, for the initiated, will be relatively obvious. And that then is then corroborated by field work, where an organisation like ASIO in Australia's case would go out there and physically check up on the actions, the travel plans, the contacts of those suspect individuals, and then develop a dossier. Now, that dossier may not necessarily be acted upon. There's a whole host of reasons why you would or wouldn't act, one of which is that, you know, we might be in negotiations for a trade deal, or there may be a delegation coming up or a VIP visit that's planned, or some other related arrangement that would be compromised if you were to push back. But so what happens is that organisations like ASIO, they build up a portfolio. They keep their powder dry for an occasion like this. And when the opportune time arises, when there is clearly a need for the government to need some ammunition, if you like, metaphorical ammunition, of course, not literal, to use in response to a perceived slight, then that's when you use the powder. That's when it gets used. And of course, that's exactly what we've just seen transpire. And that would be the case with almost all the cases of those reported across North America and Europe. The dossiers would be well and truly padded out with considerable detail, waiting for the opportune moment on which to use it.
So both countries really know what's happening. The Russians know that that the Australians know that certain people are spies, nothing's done until there's an occasion, then the Russians deny they were spies. It all sounds slightly like out of a novel, even though it's real life and is serious.
Yes, exactly. Inconceivable that something like that happened. Please, somebody round up the usual suspects.
John Blaxland, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's
my
all
pleasure.
For our present podcast. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back with you again soon.